The Holy Gospel according to Mark. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd around him gathered, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue named Jairus came, and when he saw him, fell at his feet and begged him repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be well and live." So he went with him, and a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She had endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had, and she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, for she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." Immediately, her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt her body that she was healed of her disease. Immediately after that, the power had gone forth from him. Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you. How can you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked all around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before him, and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. When he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. Then he put them all aside and told the child's father and mother and those who were with him, and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha, come," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. She was 12 years of age. As they were overcome with amazement, he strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. The Gospel of our Lord.
We have what Sandy shared with us in the second book of Samuel. Saul and Jonathan have been killed in battle, and David, who is now in deep lament and grief, has been in conflict with Saul, the king, from the get. In fact, if you remember a few Sundays back when God instructs the prophet Samuel to go anoint a new king, Saul is still in play, and so in effect, God is enacting this political coup and sets up this tension and this conflict between Saul and David. Now, the only difference between Saul and David, because if you read the story, they were both terrible kings. The only difference was that Saul continued to operate under his own steam and his own self-will. He just figured, I'm going to get this. I'm going to figure it out. Any minute now, you know, I'll gain control here. And David, making at least as many, if not more, mistakes, having as many, if not more, stupid attacks as Saul, consistently throws himself on the mercy of God every time one of his stupid attacks is brought to his attention. It's the only difference between these two kings. And here we have yet another example of that, where in the face of the death of Saul and his best friend Jonathan, David publicly laments the loss of these two people. And so he consistently engages the behavior of returning to God in order to sort of move through the day. And then we have this wonderful section of the Gospel according to Mark, chapter 5, where we have two different stories of healing, if you will. Ramping up at the beginning is this whole scene with Jairus' daughter. Jairus is the leader of the synagogue. And then right sandwiched in the middle of that comes this woman who's been bleeding for more than a decade. And as the author of Mark's Gospel tells us, she has expended all her resources and suffered at the hands of physicians. Anybody here relate to that? If we don't, we will at some point in our lives, is what I hear. That's the rumor, anyway. So she comes, she touches Jesus' garment. She is made whole. Jesus says, "Who touched my garment?" And they have this little conversation. And he says one of the most outrageous things that he says more than a couple of times in the Gospel according to Mark. "Oh, woman, your faith has made you whole." And I want to suggest today that these, both of these passages from the second book of Samuel and from the Gospel according to Mark, describe what you and I might think of as the gift of desperation. Let's give that a moment's thought. Have you ever found yourself at a place where your physical being has deteriorated, you are sick, you've gone through what this woman has gone through, and nothing seems to be working, you're getting worse and worse and worse. And out of that comes what I've observed as the gift of desperation. Where are you going to turn? Or if you're one among us who has suffered from some form of addiction or obsession or compulsion of some kind, and you've spent the vast majority of your life telling yourself, "I got this, any minute now, I'm going to gain control over this," and so you have applied all of your great and brilliant ideas, all of your hard-won worldly wisdom, all of the ways that you have been able to conjure, manipulating and controlling not just your life, but the lives of the people that you love the most, and you've tried it all, and you have hit rock bottom, and what are you going to do now? I've been there more than once. The first time was a doozy, and I remember coming to out of this and not knowing anything other than to say, "Help. Help me." And then the little old ladies in this congregation that I was serving down in downtown Los Angeles, St. James, Wilshire, they said, oh honey, say please as well. Oh, Yeah, because I was oblivious in kindergarten. I didn't learn how to do this as a kindergartner. Skipped kindergarten, actually. Help me, please. I didn't even know who I was talking to. No one in particular, but I was desperate. Have you been there? If if you've been there, good on you. And if you haven't, you know, kind of like suffering at the hands of physicians, we will get there at some point. And it can be the most transformative place we can ever land. And I call it the gift of desperation. I am so desperate now, I am willing to try absolutely anything other than what I've been trying so far. Again, all my good ideas, all my hard-won wisdom, and all of the ways that I've managed to at least tell myself I can manipulate or control this situation and my life. Boom. That's it. Help. It is both a wonderful and deeply painful place to land. And according to these stories, both with Jairus, who, by the way, this woman who is hemorrhaging would have been ostracized from the community, kicked out of the community, not allowed to be around anyone else because she is, by the ancient law, rendered unclean, therefore, you know, ostracized, shunned. And get this, Jairus, the guy who comes, the leader of the synagogue, who throws himself at Jesus' feet, he's the guy who has ostracized her. And he's the guy who is upholding this ancient tradition of shunning this woman because she's unclean, because she's bleeding. There's deep irony in this story that both the woman and the guy who has kicked the woman out of community can approach Jesus and receive and have their lives transformed. Think about that. It's almost like Jesus has no taste. I mean, you'd think he'd be a little more discriminating. Oh, Jairus, you know, you've treated this woman and others badly. You know, repent. He doesn't say that, does he? Let that sink in for a while. And so these people, out of their own desperation, out of the gift of desperation, find their lives transformed, and Jesus pronounces them healed, which we need to understand in the ancient tradition. It's not just about, oh, my little thing is gone now, oh, my little girl is better, or oh, my bleeding has stopped. Oh no, friends, when they talk about healing in the biblical tradition, in the scriptural tradition, it's talking about being restored to the community. She can now claim her place fully in the community. Jairus can claim his place and look back over his shoulder and go, maybe there's another way to do this. You know, maybe there's a different way to be the leader of this synagogue. Their lives are about to be transformed, and they're given their lives back. They are made whole. And Jesus even says to the woman, oh, your faith has made you whole. Your gift of desperation has begun your transformation. Woo. And what they're relieved of more than anything is the debilitating fear that brings them to Jesus in the first place. So, the gift of desperation, which leads to the gift of healing and transformation. Welcome to St. Peter's, where you too can experience your own desperation. And then we can get creative. Every now and again, my dad, who turned 89 in June, and he's still going strong down in Phoenix, Arizona, he sends me all kinds of goofy things by email, sometimes some off-color jokes, and other times some things that, you know, might be considered a little bit of wisdom, and here's one of them. And it goes like this. Here's a different form of desperation. When I get old, I'm going to leave snacks in little bags on the floor all over the house in case I fall down. I'm keeping that one. Because the day is coming, right? So I promised a little show and tell. When you look back on the history of this parish, St. Peter's, in Carson City, you will read and be able to connect with all kinds of moments of desperation. The history of this parish has not been an easy one. In fact, there were several times in the 150 years, in the early part of the 20th century, where the congregation was convinced that this place was going to have to be closed. You know, just board up the windows and the doors and walk away from the place. And, you know, by the grace of God and by hook and by crook, they managed to muddle through and continue on. And here we are today, standing on the shoulders of yet more desperation. And a couple of months back, Patsy Pumphrey, who is the daughter-in-law of a former rector, the Reverend Bob Pumphrey, who served this congregation in the 60s and 70s, Patsy was, and who has since died, he was 95 when he died, boy, when we're ordained and ornery, we just never go away. Patsy, in the process of moving across town in Reno, found, covered with dust and mold and mildew, two communion kits, or, tell me again, Marietta, priest companion kits, which I've never heard this phrase before, two communion kits in boxes collecting dust, and she realized immediately that these kits belonged to St. Peter's. Put them in a bag, handed them to me at our first clericus meeting. Oh yeah, that was back in January. That was more than a couple of months ago, wasn't it? And they were a mess. And so I asked Marietta, out of the goodness of her heart, if she would give some time and attention to these communion kits. Now, for our visitors, my wife is a master silversmith, a master goldsmith, a master engraver, a master enamelist, probably a couple other master of the household, master of me, yeah, Annika, I probably forgot a thing or two. Anyway, she's brilliant at this kind of work, and so she took these home and in her workshop and transformed these pieces. Now, this one was made specifically for St. Peter's, correct? This one is Tiffany, correct? Okay. This one, this communion kit, was made in Nevada, correct? Okay. This one was, well, they were both a mess. In this one, the cruet, where the wine goes, this thing was cracked, it was broken, the pieces were just laying in the box. You can see, and at the end of the service, please feel free to come up. You'll see in each of the boxes, it's kind of a mess. These are typical communion kits. They leak Jesus everywhere. And all of the, I have other communion kits, probably not as old as these, that have been given to me as gifts by various older clergy, including one that was for a bishop. And you can tell the bishop's communion kit because it's lined in purple velvet. These are usually red. I think you can see. Yeah, this one is red, which is typical of a priest's communion kit. And they leak like all do, with the exception of this dumpy little pewter, ugly, fake leather pouched communion kit that belongs to this parish. It's ugly, it's just nothing to look at, and it's the only communion kit I've ever used that does not leak. Go figure. Anyway, so you can see where, you know, Jesus is leaked all over. I have Jesus on the passenger seat of every car I've owned, you know, since I was ordained. Anyway, she has just fixed these up. They're absolutely gorgeous. Everything works now. The little chalices were coming apart. She fixed those. They were tainted. She's polished them up. Again, this one was made in Nevada in the 1899. This one, the Tiffany, 1895. And this one, the Tiffany one, was made in memory of Mariette Curry of Curry Street and the Curry House. Yeah, I mean, they were the Currys, the Yarringtons, sound familiar, founding families of this congregation and the builder of this building. This was given, and we found out this morning at the 8 o'clock that her name was Marietta, and in her teenage rebellion changed it to Mariette, which is what you'll see engraved on these pieces. They are gorgeous, and I just want to thank my wife for fixing these up in time. Susie's going to take these. Joy said, where is Susie? Where'd you go? Yeah. We'll keep them in the sacristy, and at some point as we approach our 150th, we'll put them on display in the cabinet in a way that makes sense to you folks. Anyway, they're just gorgeous pieces, and they represent our history. Now, it's one thing to celebrate our history. It's a whole other thing than to ask the question, what do we intend to leave? What's our legacy going to be? How do we want, not just the people of St. Peter's, but how do we want Carson City and other communities around the Capitol to remember us? And that question is being addressed in all kinds of ways, not the least of which in the project that hopefully will be completed this summer with the building of the labyrinth. And there's more to come, folks. And all of the ways that we involve ourselves in this community, all of the ways that we are of service, those things, not just this place, but all of those activities and all of those ways to serve also become part of our legacy as well. So we celebrate our history. A history, truth be told, comes out of the gift of desperation and a legacy born of the grace of God. So take a moment. And again, after we go outside at the end of the service and bless the ground, come on back in. Take a look at these really beautiful parts of our common life. And then, again, we're going to... Can we touch them? Yeah, she'll just clean up more messes that we make, like she does, you know, at home. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, you can look at them. So, yeah, give it up for Marietta. Yeah, hours and hours and hours and hours. So take a moment, take a nice deep breath, and then start putting your snack bags around the house. That's what I'm going to do.